Hi, it's Rebecca Whitman, your host of the Balanced, Beautiful, and Abundant Show. I'm a top-rated life coach, an international best-selling author, and a multi-passionate entrepreneur. I'm on a mission to help you go from burned out to balanced, beautiful, and abundant. The experts on this show will help you achieve work-life balance so that you can experience abundance in seven pillars of life: spirituality, health, emotions, romance, mindset, social, and financial life. When you have all seven pillars of life in alignment, you are balanced, beautiful, and abundant. Let's go. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Balanced, Beautiful, and Abundant Show. I am your host, Rebecca Whitman. We are taking you from burned out and overwhelmed to balanced, beautiful, and abundant. Thank you for all your support, your subscriptions, your reviews. The podcast is absolutely blowing up. We are in the top 0.5% globally and growing. So this podcast is helping people all over the world overcome overwhelm and burnout, and today is no different. I have incredible guests, Heather Hilliard and Ann Dranasantaris. Dranasantaris, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Rebecca.
Yes, it's great to see you. And this is a very special mother-daughter duo, and they are both experts in leadership, behavioral change, stepping out of imposter syndrome into your authentic power. So let me tell my listeners about you. Anne and Heather are a mother and daughter team, and they are organizational leadership experts at Caliber Leadership Systems, which is a boutique consulting firm specializing in dismantling dysfunction in organizations. They leverage their expertise in neuropsychology of human development. Sorry, these are like mouthfuls. All right, I'm getting some water if you're listening. They are experts in human development, behavioral change leadership, interpersonal dynamics, and organizational transformation. And they have worked with thousands of leaders, been featured in major publications, and spoken on many stages and conferences. They've written several books based on personality type and based on the brain string styles and the Myers-Briggs type indicator. So we're going to get into the brain-based striving styles, and I don't think everybody who listens knows about Myers-Briggs either, so we'll touch on what those personality types are. So tell us your story. You know, most mother and daughters are having a very tenuous relationship at this age, middle-aged women and, you know, next-generation moms, and you guys are working together. So how did your relationship evolve from mother-daughter to business partners?
Well, it's a little bit of an interesting story. Anne is my biological mother, and she actually gave me up for adoption when I was born. She was just shy of her 17th birthday, and Anne and I reunited when I was 27. And in the process of coming together and meeting each other, we discovered we had this real shared interest, orientation, kind of driving force around helping people and helping organizations to achieve their potential. And we were working in very different places and spaces at the time, but about 3 years after we met, we started our business together. So it's been 25 years now. So we didn't have any of that angst coming from, you know, teen life over into adult life. We were forging a business partnership and a relationship as family and building our business all at once as part of our journey.
How did you reunite? What was the path of finding each other?
Well, up in Canada, the way it's done here is that when you give up, or at the time anyway, you could sign up with a registry so that if you're the child you gave up for adoption at some point wanted to reunite with you, they simply contacted that agency. And when Heather was on the was engaged to be married and decided she was going to look for her medical information, And in addition to the medical information, she got a huge family instead.
I love it. So, Heather, you looked up Anne right before you were going to get married.
Yeah.
And Anne, were you shocked to hear from her? Were you kind of like intuitively expecting one day my daughter that I gave away for adoption is going to look me up? Were you like, oh, I was waiting for you? Or are you like,
yes, I was always hopeful of that. And I had started in around the age of 18, because that's the age at which, Heather could legally look me up. And I started thinking at that point, I have to prepare myself for something that's going to be coming. And fortunately, I was a bit more stable when we finally reunited than I might have been when I was a bit younger. And so it was a perfect timing for it. It couldn't have been a better time for us to get together, because I was at a place in my career, Heather was at a place in her life and career. We were both quite stable. And we came together. And so the story goes.
And are you guys a lot alike? I know we both talked about our personality types based on Myers-Briggs, and we all have very rare personality types, especially for women. Do you guys have a lot of similarities as far as your personality style goes?
Yeah, I think that that's what really helped us. And I grew up in a family where none of the women were like me. And so it was really cool to meet someone with that more of a rational brain orientation, because it's not as common in us as females, and who also had that same orientation towards personal growth and development and ambition. And, you know, and so all of that sort of, I think, really helped us in terms of forging that relationship and building those connections. I think the other thing that people always comment about was, you know, you grew up when you're adopted, nobody looks like you, nobody has mannerisms like you. And I was one of the things that was really amazing, not just from a personality similarity, but how many mannerisms we had that were very similar, even though I'd never met her before. So hand use, inflections, you know, sort of these things that just, you know, come from somewhere, but they weren't learned in my part. They were just organic. And so when they start spending time with people that look like you and behave like you and sound like you, it's a really different experience. Right. And, you know, I think always when we think about that conversation that I know we're going to get into around the imposter is, you know, part of that piece, and especially because I was still in my 20s, right. It's like, figuring out where you belong is a big part of our journey in our 20s. And I always knew that I didn't really quite belong. I'm a wonderful, you know, experience growing up in my adoptive family. And so I'm not knocking them, but there was always that piece of where I didn't quite belong. And so I think it was just because I didn't have that intellectual cerebral connection with the people that I grew up with or the people that were in my family. And so finding that in my biological family was really cool and allowed me to, I think, grow and develop in ways that I wouldn't have otherwise.
Oh, that is so well said. So let's talk about did you create the string striving styles, striving yeah. styles personality type? Tell me, how did you create that? What does it mean? What are the different styles? This is the first I've ever heard of it.
So I had been working with the striving styles in my psychotherapy and coaching practice, and, you know, starting around, I think I first got certified in about 1982 in the Myers-Briggs. I fell in love with Jung when I was doing my psychotherapy training. And this Myers-Briggs is simply an instrument for really determining Jung's theory of psychological type, how the brain is wired mm-hmm. functionally to take in information and to make decisions. And so as Heather and I progressed in our consulting firm doing work with leaders, we were using the emotional intelligence assessment, we were using the Myers-Briggs, we were using leadership assessment, and we decided that we were going to evolve the Myers-Briggs, as it were, and include the emotional drivers of behavior, which are our emotional needs. And so including emotional intelligence into brain function, we came up with the striving styles. And of course, the other piece of that is part of it came from an article that I did for Oprah Magazine. I think it was 2009, Heather, 2009, called Who Are You Meant to Be? And that article is still online. It was one of the top articles of that year. And from that, we developed it up in not just into our assessment, but also into a whole system that we have reports for leaders. We have reports for employees. We have reports for relationships. So everything surrounding each of the personality types or striving styles, we have supporting information for each of those.
Well, congratulations on having one of the most popular articles on Oprah Magazine. That's amazing. Tell us, what are the striving styles? Tell us a little bit about each personality type and what differentiates them from the others.
And so we look at it as eight sort of these archetypes, right, that represent the different functions of the brain and whether you use it in an introverted or an extroverted way. So without getting sort of too technical on it, and I'm going to start with those that are in the rational brain. So there's our leader, and they are differentiated because they have a need to be in control. And the primary driver of their behavior is around getting that need to be in control met. Then we have our intellectual, who has the need to be knowledgeable. So you think about those people that you work with or you come across, or maybe if you're like me, you're married to them, where they gather lots of information about everything, but don't necessarily seem to ever make any decisions about it or use the information for anything. That's our intellectuals. Moving over into the intuitive function, so Myers-Briggs language, the right rational brain, the performer, of which I am one, so the need to be recognized, so that desire to be out and to be seen and to really be able to grow and develop from that perspective. Oprah is another great example. And the visionary, so that INTJ, if you know Myers-Briggs language, so that need to be perceptive, to see all the pieces and how they all come together. And then we have our artist with the need to be creative. That's in the feeling function. Same with the socializer, with that need to be connected. You know, those folks that are out there that are always gathering people up, it seems to be, and saying, oh, I know you need to talk to this person and you need to belong there and you need to join here. Those are our social connectors. And we literally call them the socializers for that reason. And then rounding out the eight, and that's in the folks that are really oriented and driven around the experiential function, we have our adventurer with the need to be spontaneous, which again, core driver of their behavior is I want to do something different and I want to be out and I want to play, and work supports my play as opposed to the other way around. And then last but not least, the stabilizer, which is driven by the need to be secure. And so these are the folks who like to do things the same way they've always done it, one foot after the other in the same spots. You see a lot of those in organizational environments like the military, like banking, like the government, where things are very structured and rule bound. But you also see them gravitating into roles of responsibility as well. So those in a snapshot are the eight, but you'll notice, I mean, there's obviously a lot of complexity behind that. And what I love about our system is that it doesn't just tell you how you behave. It really gets into what this means you need to do from a brain development perspective in order to really be able to leverage your full potential. Because for us on our journey as human beings, it is about learning how to use all four of the functions of our brain together in order to be ultimately successful in achieving that potential. And a lot of the other tools that were out there didn't really get at the why people were behaving the way they were, or what was it we really needed to do about it. And so when we created this, those were some of the key things we were trying to answer, so that developmental activities became really crystal clear and we could stop guessing at what do I need to do in order to really step into my potential. I actually had a roadmap for doing it.
So how do people find out what their striving style is? Do you guys have a quiz, or do they need to go to your website? What would be the next step if someone wanted to know their striving style?
We do have an online assessment that people can go to. It's whoareyoumeanttobe.com.
Nice.
And the path to the assessment is there. And
okay.
So after they take the assessment, they get a report along with it, and it has some resources there. We also have a YouTube channel with lots of yummy videos about each of the striving styles and their imposter syndrome as well, because each of the imposter syndromes in each of the styles show themselves in different ways with different characteristics.
Wow, that sounds amazing. So what do you think my striving style is, just based on our limited interactions?
Well, you gave it away with a visionary. You're a visionary with leader.
Okay, awesome. Yes.
And so that need to understand, the need to put everything together, the need to take what is and create something very different. And I always like to say that visionaries, because their first function is introverted, they like to play in their utopian palace of possibilities. Ooh, where ideas
that is
wild and abundant.
Wait, I need to digest that. I like to play in the utopian palace of possibilities. Is that what? Did you say utopian palace?
Yes.
Wow, what an image. That's beautiful. Utopian palace. You also bring in the abundance there, because a palace is like opulent and luxurious. Yeah. Yes, I totally resonate with that. That's amazing. And I don't feel like I have imposter syndrome, even though a lot of people do who listen to this show. Like, I don't feel like I have. I have the opposite. Like, I'm a recovering perfectionist, so I'm a like overachiever. So I'm usually upset that I'm not further ahead, and I compare myself to other people that are further ahead and going, well, why am I not getting what she's getting? So I feel like I don't have imposter syndrome, because I'm kind of like never satisfied with where I am and always striving for more.
So it's one of the fundamental things, and it's expressed differently in each of the striving styles. It's simply another way of saying, I'm not enough. You see that, and this is something that has to do with the brain, because what is possible and what is your potential is for the future. And you're always comparing yourself to where you are relative to that and wanting to be in the palace.
Right.
Because current reality is never as exciting as what we imagine for ourselves.
Right. So how would someone, because I imagine there's other people listening to the show that are like me, that are constantly striving for more and feel like they're never enough. What is the antidote for the constant achievers and strivers to actually not always be looking for the palace, but to just feel love and appreciation for where they are on their journey?
I think the what we try and do is say, it's not that we're trying to rein in the ambition, because that's hardwired. For some of us in our personality types, we're just natural builders. We always want to master the next stage, and we always want the next stage we're mastering to be bigger than the one we are on. And that's core to who we are and our potential. So we're not trying to negate that. What we're trying to do is, you know, Anne talked about this a little bit, is we've got this idea, our utopian sort of that vision that we hold. But what we start doing is we're measuring today against that, even though that is a desired future state. And so what we want to do is bring it into, what are those achievable milestones, which is really where we should be tracking. Are we progressing or are we not? And celebrating, because the challenge is we're always measuring against this ideal, not based on what have I done and achieved so far. We don't look back. Our brain's not wired to look backwards in the same way that other people do to say, wow, look at how far we've come. Like, we don't do that. We're always going, look at how far I want to go, and I'm not there yet. And that's the struggle. And so we have to learn to balance those two things out and recognize when it's a time for us to be looking at where do we want to be versus where we are, to build our strategy and our plans. And then as we're moving through that, to be celebrating those milestones and those progressions, and not necessarily saying we've got to be somehow magically be satisfied, but also just, again, in keeping with the language around the imposter syndrome, questioning, if am I going after that so I feel like I'm enough? Or is there other reasons that are really driving that, so that we're not going after those ambitions out of our persona, but really from that place of authenticity? What is my path? What am I here for? And how does that fit against that? Not, I want a bigger house, I want more travel, I want, you know, because that could be coming out of that imposter persona where if I have all of these things, then I'll be enough, right? Because I've got that external validation that says, you know, yes, I'm enough, but inside it's never enough because we haven't done that work along the journey. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So what I'm hearing you say is it's okay to be ambitious and want more. If it's purpose-driven to make an impact, to leave a positive legacy, to just, because I'm just so aware that our time on this earth is so limited and every day is a precious gift. And I want to just give as much and put out as much good as I can versus, you know, filling that God-sized hole in your heart with validation. Like, I need the bigger house and the newer car and the fancier jewelry just to feel like I'm okay, just enough. So I think it's kind of like the come from is one is healthier than the other. I think a lot of people are validation addicts and they're trying to use success and achievement to fill their God-sized hole and they haven't done the healing first.
Yeah,
and it's like giving from the overflow, like feeling like you are already enough and your cup is already full and then producing results from that overflow versus from a deficit. Like I need this stuff to fix me. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Okay. So one of the things that we talk to our clients about, especially when they have our brain, like the rational brain style, is that because we see ourselves at our potential, we can see others at their potential. We have this really difficult time with being average or doing anything average. Mm-hmm. And that's the mechanism that can really make a difference in someone's life when they recognize that they're constantly judging themselves. And certainly the practice of mindfulness is really effective for people in letting go of this constant, you know, am I still alive? How good am I doing relative to, you know, the Joneses next door, because it's really hard to be human and just allow ourselves to be when we're constantly in that search for our own perfection and that perfect state that we want to live in.
That is well said. And it's about being a human being, not a human doing, and just being present in our five senses and enjoying just being alive and being here without the constant self-pressure to strive and strive and strive. So that is, if we can all make that shift, everybody who's listening, and just we can still have goals and dreams, but also just be present, enjoy the moment. Like Heather said, celebrate the wins that you've had. I don't think a lot of women especially were not celebrating the wins as much as we could and as much as we deserve to. So let's get into the meat and potatoes of this interview. How do we go from imposter syndrome to stepping into our authentic power? And let's start with the definition. How do you guys define, because you said I might have imposter syndrome too, even though I didn't think I did. How do you guys define imposter syndrome?
So in a nutshell, we look at the imposter syndrome as a developmental gap. And as Anne referenced there, it's like where we've got this pervasive feeling that we struggle with, where we're not enough, right? Where we're somehow in all of what we're doing, no matter what we might achieve or what other evidence we might have around us, that feeling of enough isn't there. I'm not smart enough. I'm not successful enough. I'm not, you know, sort of liked enough. It's like whatever is that definition again. And for each personality, it does show up a little bit differently. And that when we look at it as a developmental gap, what it really is that fact that as we grow up in childhood, our brain is wired to ensure our survival. And we end up having these experiences in our childhood that our brain adapts to in order to ensure our survival. And as we continue to grow and grow up from an age perspective, we don't necessarily do that thing of checking in to say, hey, are those strategies that I used in my childhood to ensure my survival, do those still work for me today? And so this message track that we might have formed in childhood, you know, and some of it comes from our parents, to be fair. Some of it comes from teachers, like, who do you think you are? And why do you think that's good enough for you? And no, you need to be practical. You need to not chase your own goals. Like all of those things that get embedded into us, you know, where we continue to use them and to bring them forward every time we have experiences in our adult life. And from that, then the conclusion is always that somehow I'm not enough, and we're working against that. And so from a development perspective, we're trying to understand, what is that messaging? What's that story we have in our head? And it translates out into different behaviors: perfectionism, procrastination, self-neglect, and help me out with this, my list here.
Self-sabotage, low self-esteem.
So there's lots of, you know, and so and a lot of people wouldn't necessarily say, oh, well, being a perfectionist, that's a sign of the imposter syndrome. But in fact, it is. And so so there's all these things in essence that we do and in our behavior that actually keeps us in this place and keeps us feeling like somehow we're not good enough.
So what? Before we talk about how to go from imposter to authentic power, what is authentic power? How do we find that authentic self underneath all these layers of unprocessed childhood trauma?
Well, and just for clarification, we don't necessarily have to be traumatized to have a developmental delay. We simply have excessive adaptation to the cultural norms. And, you know, one can argue that's a trauma, but that's another show.
Yeah.
But our brain gets wired to behave the same way, to adapt. And then all of the neurotransmitters in the brain are set up to reward us and make us feel good when we keep conforming. And this is where, when Heather and I talk about, you know, making this shift from the imposter syndrome to our authentic self, we have to recognize that we're changing the physiology of the brain. This isn't just a, you know, kick the imposter syndrome to the curb, because we have this self-protective persona that we have put a lot of energy into cultivating. And the first step to answer your question is, we have to recognize that there are two different places that we can operate from. And one is that persona that we've crafted so that we can get along in life and do what we do in life. And then there's the inner, the authentic self with all of our hopes, dreams, ambitions, desires. And some of those go into our persona. They go into the formation. But it's having to drop those behaviors that we use that are no longer serving us. As Heather said earlier, you know, we just keep using them even after they've served their purpose. And so the first step is to really nail down that duality.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
and then, Heather, you guys are doing an interview duet. It's like...
Yeah. That's right.
You guys give each other, you know, equal playtime in this beautiful mother-daughter duet. So yeah, and then, you know, now what? Now that we have differentiated.
Right, that's a self-awareness piece of
that.
Yeah.
Self-awareness.
Have to be aware.
But rewiring the brain, it doesn't happen overnight. So what are some disciplines or practices we can use once we're aware, okay, this is not my authentic self, whether it comes from childhood trauma or society, which is, you know, incredibly shallow these days. How do we rewire?
So the first thing is to understand, as Anne was saying, like, where are we starting from, right? And to actually accept that as our reality. Like, I know from you on this journey, and for those of you that are familiar with different personality types that are out there, I had an experience once where, you know, this group that I was involved in, we had to go through this personality assessment that I wasn't familiar with. And it came back that I was, I don't know, I think a star or something, right? And I'm like, well, that's not me. That's not who I am. What are you talking about? And I remember being so offended and defensive about that was somehow part of me. And so I think even as we're talking about this, there is work to be done to really not only understand who we are authentically, but to embrace that and really be okay with that. And so as Anne and I developed the striving styles, and it kept coming back, yep, that I have a need to be recognized. That's just fundamental. And if you look through my entire life, there's a gazillion examples that are all about, I mean, I learned to play the piano as a kid, not because I like to play the piano, but because I like to get up on the stage to perform in front of other people for recognition. So when right. you start to actually look at that and say, well, that's really core and fundamental to me. So then if I'm going after, you know, again, authentic power is I'm recognizing that unique ability about myself, that ability to get up and to put myself out there and put myself on the stage and to be able to do that in a way that compels others. Then I start to organize my vision for myself and my vision for my life, making sure that that need is being met. So instead of trying to keep it small or to, you know, to be more subtle or to not, it's like I own it and I'm okay with that. And that is just so fundamental to who I am. And so we start to see that shift in us when we're really going after that authentic power where we can voice who we are, what is unique about us. And equally, we can say things like, yep, my ego is not tied to my cooking skills. The fact that I buy cookies for my kids to take to school as opposed to baking them. Like I'm not comparing myself to others because I understand and value what is unique about me. And I'm going to create my world and my life to deliver against that, not to fulfill some, to play some role or to meet someone else's expectations. So that's part of that authentic power where I can really feel like I don't have to adapt and I'm entitled to be who I am without apology and without reservation.
That is so beautiful. And that is kind of very feminist, first of all, you know, women have been so subjugated that they have to look a certain way, act a certain way, be a certain way. And not all women are like that. For example, like we all have a very rational personality type, which could be even considered like masculine or logical. Yeah. And sure. People could consider us like remote or not connected, but it's not that. Like we love people so much. We're just more in our logical side of our brain, but you can even talk about body image, right? Like what you just said, not every woman is meant to look like a, you know, runway model in Paris, which is like, you know, 2% or 1% of the women have that tall, lanky body, and like just loving and accepting their body type for who they are. Of course, we want to be strong, fit, and healthy. It's one of the seven pillars of abundance. But it's different to want to be fit and strong for longevity reasons.
Yes.
Versus
yes.
like to fit in and look a certain way for approval. So what you were saying really helps women step into their power because when you're being your authentic self, you're not doing it because you're trying to get other people's approval or validation. You're doing it because that's who you are.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's what we mean by the developmental gap. It's that dependency on approval is a stage of development that all human beings go through. But we're meant to move beyond it and self-regulate and internalize and use our power, our authentic power to decide what works for us and not stay dependent on the approval and recognition of other people.
So what age of development is approval seeking and when do we grow out of it? Because I feel like our whole culture is stuck in approval seeking. So what is the next step of evolution past that for a healthy person?
Yeah. We jokingly say that, you know, even though we think we're really evolved as humanity is really evolved, it's really not that evolved. Like no. We're just coming into greater consciousness all the time. It hasn't been that long since we even recognized that there were stages of psychological development. And yep. And so if you look at most people get stuck in the teenage years using coping strategies and, you know, conflict resolution strategies that are about that age of, you know, fight or flight or, you know, yep. let me be helpful to stay with my social group and let me dress the same and look the same and wear labels so that I'll fit in. And if people don't realize they're stuck, and this is the thing about the imposter syndrome, that people don't recognize that they're stuck in this developmental delay, they can't do anything about it.
So people are walking around as overgrown teenagers, because that is That is the age where approval seeking is the most important. So in a healthy person, let's say they go out of the phase as a teenager, they're no longer approval seeking. What is the next phase of a healthy person if they move through that? That would probably be in their 20s. What would they
later.
Be?
Later, actually. Yeah.
They would be what?
Later than the 20s. You have to think of the 20s as still a part of your teenage years. So okay. From a brain development perspective, it's still adolescent brain, especially for males, because they're, 28, 29 before their brain actually finishes maturing. So you're looking more as you head into your 30s and that individuation, right, where we're starting to truly say, who am I and what do I stand for? And we're starting to think about our own values. And it's the intent in that stage as we move from there into our 40s is that we're starting to step into that authentic power. Our 20s are us exploring and trial and error and learning what works and what doesn't work and having experiences that inform as we move into that next stage. But there's still, if you think about, people starting their careers, they're still approval seeking. You think about people going into relationships that lead into marriage. There's still this sort of, codependence that they're working through at that particular stage because they haven't quite, there's still a connection to parent and parental approval, right? And there's still folks in their 20s working on career paths because their parents told them, yes, go be a doctor and a lawyer. No, don't go be an artist. I don't care how talented you are, right? And so there is those aspects. So it's actually as we move into our 30s and 40s where you start to see that transition out. Yeah. In a developing person. Sorry, let me qualify. Doesn't happen automatically.
So when does the brain stop developing? Are there just stages for every decade until somebody's 100 years old and dies? Or is it just like they peak out like in their 40s where they're an individuated person? How does that work?
Psychological development can last a long time. It's when the light of consciousness gets turned on in a human being. And that doesn't happen for everyone. And so if you're coming at it from a Jungian perspective, Jung said that about the age of 43, there's a fundamental shift to, letting go of societal expectations and starting on the road to individuation. And so following that dependent stage, there's independence and interdependence, and then we go into that higher level of, who am I as a spiritual being? Who am I as a social being? What do I want to give back? And these things happen in people's lives based on whether or not they're just living at the financial survival level and they're constantly in fear, or whether they've had the opportunity and have been driven by a need to develop themselves.
Okay. Well, this has been very interesting. I did not expect this interview to take this turn, but you guys have really inspired me to ask these questions. So let's shift gears a little bit and talk about leadership, because a lot of leaders listen to this show. And I know you work with a lot of organizations and you work with leaders. So what do all successful leaders have in common?
Well, at the core, a really high level of self-awareness. Mm-hmm. So that awareness of, who am I, where are my strengths, where are my gaps, and that ability to bring that into the conversation. So they've moved out of that persona or that sort of faking it till they make it sort of stage and really recognizing that, this is my style as a leader. These are the situations in which I excel. And this is what I need from the people around me and the processes around me in order to support me. So they really come out of that place of thinking, I can do it at all and I can be an expert at everything and I don't need anything or anyone, to really being able to look at themselves authentically and to lead from that place of, as we talk about that, leading others from that place where it's not that I don't have to be autocratic and I don't have to be permissive, but I really get to exercise my own authority. And I feel entitled to actually be a leader and to lead, not just to show up and keep people happy, or not just to, make sure I'm commanding and controlling things, but really being able to exercise our power in that leadership. Those, the ones that are really successful, understand that and understand what they have to do personally in order to get comfortable in that space.
That is so important, because I feel like a leader has to be self-aware and know where their zone of genius is and where they need support and help, because they can't be everything to everyone or they're going to burn out. That's the whole point of the show, helping people overcome burnout and overwhelm. Mm-hmm. So knowing what your zone of genius is and excelling in that, which is way more fun than trying to do all these other things that are not in your zone of genius, and just delegating. I think delegation is so important for leadership. Would you like to add anything to this, Anne? What makes a successful leader?
The only thing I would add to it is, you know, in today's complexity where leaders are expected to be more psychologically astute and, you know, empathetic and to be able to take care of the emotional needs of their people without any training. I think, you know, the risk that a lot of leaders are facing these days is these unrealistic expectations and trying to be too many things. To your point, Rebecca, about they're just trying to take on so much and be all things to all people, and they're getting burnt out and exhausted because nobody's feeding them. Nobody's giving them the training and development that we need. And many organizations Heather and I work with, the leaders are hungry to change their behavior, to know how to do things, but they've never had any training in how to be a leader. They know functionally they're really successful, but the people leadership side, they're constantly feeling like they're not enough. And that's where the imposter syndrome shows up there.
So leaders that are listening, you get to be poured into too. That's why you're listening to this podcast. So high five there. But yeah, it's about leaders pouring into their own personal development and not just always giving, which causes burnout when you're constantly giving and not replenishing. So what makes a toxic leader, or which would cause a toxic work environment? I know you guys have been hired to heal toxic work environments. What would make a toxic leader or a toxic work environment, and how do we heal that? And that'll be our last question.
So we, when we look at it, we talk about it in terms of dysfunction that gets created, right? And that, you know, dysfunction is a normal part of what goes on in organizational life, where there's the potential for function and functionality, there's the potential for dysfunction. And if you look at it from that place of, you know, what then crosses that line into being toxic is where we have leaders who are so self-protective. So all of their energy is going into protecting themselves, their persona, their ego, their image of themselves. And because of that, their behavior then crosses that line into dysfunction and toxicity. So for example, we have a client and, you know, at an executive level where, you know, colleagues on the executive team or one of his direct reports will make a comment about something and he'll say things like, "What are you, stupid?" You know, and so this, that then fosters that sort of, it's like everybody sort of shrinks from that. Nobody says anything, nobody challenges it. And then we end up in this dynamic that is no longer productive because everybody becomes afraid. And that's the challenge when you've got a leader who at the core is afraid. And because they're afraid, they don't talk about it that way, but because they are afraid, they lack the training, they don't feel competent, all kinds of things. They use these self-protective behaviors that keep them feeling like they are in control, that they're looking good, but the impact on everybody else is toxic. And there's lots of things that we do in those situations, but part one of the first thing, and I'll pass it over to Anne that because I'm sure she'll have more to add, but the one of the first things we say to people, if you are in this environment, you have to learn to depersonalize. You need, yes, to learn to separate that this is about them and this is not about you. Because that CEO who's saying, "What are you, stupid?" is saying, in this moment, whatever you're saying to me is making me feel stupid, so therefore you must be stupid, right? So if we start to take that out and say, okay, he's not really actually thinking I'm stupid. It's like whatever I'm saying or how I'm saying it, it's not connecting for him yet. I need to take a step back and come back at this, but not let it hit my confidence, my emotional state, my psychological well-being, because I understand it's about the leader I'm dealing with and it's not about me as an individual.
And that leader in this example would say, what are you stupid to anyone? It's not personal.
Nope.
That's their just coping mechanism. Yep. And that reminds me of the Course in Miracles, and I'm just paraphrasing it, but every conversation is either giving love or a request for love. And the opposite of love is fear. So when people are acting toxic, they're really coming from fear and they're requesting healing and love. Yeah. So what would you like to add to this, Anne?
Well, to your point, Rebecca, about fear, it's employees understanding that when a leader behaves that way, they go into their own fear pattern and they start blaming the leader, and then they'll stop doing things like initiating, or they'll stop, they won't say, you know, I prefer it if you don't call me stupid, you know, and move on with the car. They actually shut down, and they're the silos, the us and them, and, you know, creating more toxicity. But the employees don't think that they're contributing. You see, it's just the leader's fault, and the leader's the only one that needs to change. And, you know, in the work that in particular that Heather's done in organizations where she goes in and works with that next level of leaders and putting in systems where they actually start moving with their authentic energy and not just tolerating bad behavior. Because nobody ever gets fired for saying, please don't call me stupid. It's just, I've never heard of a case, but people live in fear of just making a simple boundary like that.
I think people are scared of getting fired. And with, you know, the crazy economy and crazy times that we're in, people are like, well, I just better keep my mouth shut and take the verbal and emotional abuse from my boss because I don't want to lose my job. I think that is the fear of why people don't set the boundary and say, please don't call me stupid.
Yeah, but it's
the story.
The evidence. It's a story.
Sorry.
Yeah. If you know of someone who's actually been fired for saying, please don't call me stupid, you know, we have executive vice presidents who are afraid to ask the CEO for performance expectations because they might get fired. I mean, there's all kinds of inflammatory things we can do in our brain to scare ourselves into being quiet.
This has been so interesting.
Power.
Huh?
We don't own our power when we do that.
Let's end with this. Give us each one tip on how to step into our authentic power. If we could just do this one thing, it would put us, I know it's not an overnight thing, but it would put us on the path, on the trajectory to stepping into more of our authentic power. Just if you could have one more point, maybe this would be on a billboard on the side of the highway, like do this one thing. What would yours be, Heather?
It would be to take action. Because a lot of times I think we think about it, we complain about it, we talk about it, we wish we were something, but we don't do that. What's the one thing I can do today that actually moves me closer to knowing who I am, knowing what my potential is, and being on that path towards that powerful vision that I have for myself, is to just take action.
I love it. Take action. And what is your one step that we could do today to step into our authentic power, Anne?
Well, what I find is a lot of people are trying to get rid of their fears before they take action. So to Heather's point, I would simply add, feel your fear and do it anyway.
Yes.
Because it's not going anywhere.
It's normal to have fear of failure. And I think it's about reframing failure, right? There are only two things that happen. We either win or we learn. And my husband and I are doing this thing at night. We got it from Sarah Blakely. where we say where we failed today. And we're just talking about it every day. And we're desensitizing ourselves to our fear of failure. And we've been doing it for a couple weeks and it's working. So there you go. So I know people are going to want to keep in touch with you and maybe take that striving personality type assessment quiz. Where can they find you? And I'll definitely link the quiz in the show notes.
Thank you.
Probably the easiest thing to do is check out our website. It's dranitsaris-hilliard.com. So spelling to be found in the show notes there. And through that place, you can access everything, our books, our YouTube channel, our podcast, Striving Styles, everything is there in one place. Also a place that you can just reach out directly to us as well.
Perfect. Well, thank you guys so much for listening to another amazing episode of the Balanced, Beautiful, and Abundant podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca Whitman, helping you go from burned out and overwhelmed to balanced, beautiful, and abundant. If you love this show as much as I know you did, go ahead and copy the link, share it with a friend, and don't forget to leave a 5-star review. This is really important to keep our show growing. And if you could take a screenshot of yourself listening to the show on your phone and tag me at Rebecca E. Whitman, I will definitely give you a shout out on Instagram. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Heather. Thank you, Anne, for being my guest. And we will see you next time with another amazing show. And until we meet again, keep your vibe high and magnetized. Thanks, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to another amazing episode of the Balanced, Beautiful, and Abundant podcast. It's your loyal listening that makes our show top 0.5% in the world. I would love to connect with you in person. We're having our second international retreat October 3rd through 6th in Belize. If you like yoga, sound baths, and want to get all 7 pillars of abundance to a level 10, this retreat is for you. Just go to the link tree in the show notes to snag your $200 off promo code before April 15th. And let's end the year 2024 with momentum so that going into 2025, you will have so much abundance in all areas of life that you will be setting yourself up for the most incredible year ever. It is going to give you something to look forward to all year. Make sure you snag your spot before April 15th. And if you have any questions, you can always email me at RebeccaElizabethWhitman.com. My email address is on my website. Thank you so much for your loyal listening. And we will see you on the next episode. And some of you lucky ladies will see you in Belize. Bye.